Hey everyone, welcome to Film Class Zeros. We watch old flicks and we talk about them, as film nerds do. I'm Alex, and with me is America's number one uphill ice skater, Rich. What's going on, dude?
I like that intro. What's up, man? How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to be talking about this movie. We are talking about 1998's Blade.
I love this movie. I saw this movie in the theater when it came out with my buddy Tom Kim in the Astoria United Artists Theater on Steinway and 30th Avenue. And I have very fond memories of this. And you know what? The CGI on this movie does not hold up. It wasn't good to begin with. And in 2022, looking at it from a different lens, it's not that great. But the movie rocks.
Yeah, the movie rocks. The CGI is very bad. We will certainly talk about that. Mm-hmm. I like your like very specific like intro about like this is where I was, this is when who I was with. It's like exposition in a time travel movie where like I need to remember that because later we're gonna go back in time and find you at the movies.
I wish we had access to time travel. I'd go watch these. You know what? If we had a time machine, I would do the nerdy thing, and I'm sure you would too. Is not so much go back and change history, but you know, maybe we'll go back and see Star Wars in the movie theater. You know, like 1977.
I think about that. I think about like how like I would do like the dumbest things with the power of time travel. I wouldn't go and like verify like historical disputes. I would just go to like old school Disney World and see like all the old rides.
Oh, absolutely.
It'll be wasted on me.
So let's get into it, man.
Certainly. So Blade, released August 21st, 1998, directed by Stephen Norrington. He went on to do League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and then thankfully not much else after that. That was pretty bad. Moving swiftly on. Starring Wesley Snipes and Boucher Wright, Kris Kristofferson, Stephen Dorff, and Donald Logue, who he's been in a bunch of things, but he really gets to shine. And I feel like this is sort of like his breakout thing. Am I right?
I want to agree with you, but he's always been one of my favorite actors. You know, in again, going watching this movie through that 2022 lens, seeing him in it is fantastic, you know, because you could tell like he's chewing scenery. He's arguably one of the better parts of the cast. Stephen Dorff, in my opinion, he became a better actor as he got older.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have a whole thing with Stephen Dorff. He's someone who's like, I know him in this context of like 90s movies, but I didn't really follow him. But yeah, Donald Logue is great. Choose the scenery, choose the cast members some of the times. This is a vampire movie. Blade is a daywalker, a person with enhanced physical abilities of the enhanced physical capabilities of a vampire without their weaknesses, such as they burn in the sunlight and things like that. He's a vampire hunter on a mission to destroy the society of vampires that operate in secret, and they hunt humans for food, as they do. He is aided by Whistler, his mentor, trainer, and man at arms.
So the movie doesn't give you a lot of exposition, which is great, you know, and we've talked about this on this show several times, where I think part of the movies that we love growing up from, be it from like the 70s, 80s, or 90s, or even the 60s, is like you get plopped into this unreal situation without a lot of hand holding. You know, the opening credits of this film are you get a hint of who Blade is, almost, where it's a pregnant woman gets wheeled into the hospital. There's something wrong with the baby. Baby turns out to be Blade. She got bitten while she was pregnant. So now he came out as like this vampire human hybrid that could walk around during the day. And now he's just hunting vampires. You know, like you get thrown right into it. There's nothing that leads you into like any kind of like origin story except for that first 2 minutes of the film and then some dialogue later on. And I really appreciate that about this movie. You know, it seemed like they really, this is like a time before the X-Men franchise and any like, I would say like really top-notch superhero flick. And they throw you into it. They make a fun vampire superhero movie and you almost forget it's a Marvel flick.
I think a lot of people have completely forgotten that it's a Marvel flick up until just recently. And you're right. It, you know, this is as much setup and origin as we get. And it's like a blink and you'll miss it sort of scene because we get right into the, you know, the action. Immediately it starts off with, it's a young 90s couple going off and doing some things. And this beautiful woman is leading some guy into like a secret club / like it's hidden in a meat locker. As the audience, you kind of know he's literally being like led to his own like demise, and but they really sort of like sex it up. You know, it's like a club of sexy people who we all know are vampires. Then this guy is sort of just like completely like doe-eyed and thinking he's, you know, it's the coolest stuff in the world. But this is how we're gonna kick things off.
And that actor was Kenneth Johnson, known later on from FX's The Shield.
He looks, he's like, I think it's like supposed to be, yeah, these are like young club people, but he looks 35. Did everyone just look older? Is this like a perpetual thing with us? Or we just have like this weird lens?
I think you're nailed the age, because he's in his late 50s at this point.
Okay.
You know, so like he's like in his 30s or whatever. Yeah, I think he was supposed to be like genuinely in his 30s, and everybody's a little older in this flick. And that's another thing I like, where it's not your typical vampire fare of like the Lestat or the Twilight vampire, you know, like not everybody's pretty, like everybody's pretty gross in this. Like all the vampires are gross in this movie.
I don't know. I think some of them are pretty good looking. Everyone's like, they're all like really like, they're super horny vampires though.
They're very horny. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Every vampire is horny, but I think they're just generally horny for blood, you know?
They're horny for blood. They're horny for dancing. Even the person who was bringing him in, you know, Tracy Lord, she's from the pornos, and she's the vampire that draws him in.
Great little cameo too. You know, like this is, it's hard to put into words like some of the feelings I have of this movie, because for all intents and purposes, like the movie was a success. It was made on a $45 million budget, and I think it made $131 million at the box office. For all intents and purposes, like, this could have been a fun B movie, but you know, especially with Tracy Lords in it, but it's something that much more.
Do you think her cameo to like catch dudes out in the movie theater? Like somebody's like, hey, I know her. And then it was like, from where? And you're like,
from the pornos.
It's kind of like, I think I saw her in a documentary.
There's a lot of people in this movie. The cast is like pretty strong, you know, like especially with like Snipes playing the lead role, which was originally, I think, offered to Lawrence Fishburne and Denzel, which would have been two vastly different movies. But he's perfect for it, I think, also because of his martial arts background. It works with the character. You know?
For sure. Yeah.
And Kris Kristofferson being in the movie, which is wild to me, because this dude is a highwayman. You know, he's a country legend and an actor in his own right. And for him to be like, yeah, I'll do this movie, which is like maybe like 30 years after the second remake of, he was in a version of A Star Is Born. This dude is a legendary songwriter. And he's like, yeah, I'll be the weird guy in the movie, in your movie.
Yeah, he's like, I'll be like Q and Alfred put together, but I'm also gonna be like this, you know, American badass kind of dude,
right, with the guns and like the know-how and all that stuff, just like a grizzled old vet trying to help Blade, and also like kind of Blade's dad.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, I think it's great. And it's fun to think about like the casting choices, because you'd think like, obviously, like, you know, like Lawrence Fishburne and Denzel Washington are fantastic actors. It's fun to sort of imagine what their takes would be. You're sort of led to think that Fishburne's portrayal would be like Orpheus in The Matrix, and I feel like Denzel's version of this is like him in Book of Eli.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I was thinking for Denzel like more of like the Equalizer, which was like a little later on.
Yeah, no, yeah, I mean these are good too, but yeah, but I mean this is the fun. If we had that time machine and we could go and start like moving names around, what would we say?
I do think Lawrence Fishburne would have done a physical performance as well, but I don't think it would have been, I think Snipes was the perfect guy. Even now, like, you know, I think he's in his like early 60s, maybe. I still feel like he could do it, but you know, we're getting Mahershala Ali's Blade, which is also pretty fantastic.
I was thinking about this earlier, and I think that even though Wesley Snipes has been established as like this action movie star, I still think he's underrated, because I think he has that capability and he does such amazing things. And you know, like the stories of how he is on the set, as far as his performance are concerned, he should have had so much more. You know, we should have been given so much more. I mean, he has a huge career, but like, you know, when you hear of like, and he's in Demolition Man and all his fights where he's like, they have to slow him down because he's too fast, I wholeheartedly believe it, because you can see his physicality in this movie.
Oh, absolutely. He's all over the place in this movie. Yeah. You know, and like, I think he's a legitimate nth degree, whatever, black belt in Taekwondo. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, he's kicking the crap out of everybody. And it's great, you know, and you can tell like they really worked on the action scenes with him, and they're very believable.
100%. I think that his skill and talent as a martial artist is very present in the screen. The choreography it's very clear how hard and how seriously he took this part of it and how much he was enjoying it. And with this the way he characterizes Blade, who is like so no nonsense, but it's, you get this from Wesley Snipes just taking it 100% seriously. At the very least, these two things, he's giving it his all.
Oh yeah, 100%. And you can, and this is such a good, I feel like, organic flick also, because he is so badass in this movie. Like, let's just go into the beginning. The opening scene, it's the sexy vampire underground rave techno club that they release blood from the sprinklers to feed all these vampires, and everybody's having like a great time. They're about to eat this dude, and then boom, all of a sudden Blade shows up.
Oh yeah, it was great. I think the bloodbath, it's like supposed to be like, oh, look at this crazy sexy blood stuff, sprinkles, and it's a nightmare for this dude who's getting tenderized at this moment because they're just pounding on him, and he falls at the feet of Blade, who's just sort of like completely like clean and not covered in the mess that everyone else is, but it spotlighted and ready to just kick someone's ass.
Yeah, and very serious, super serious. Like, the character is very serious. It's not, he has a couple of quips that are great in the movie, but it's a far cry from what we get from superhero flicks now, where every other sentence is a quip.
Yeah, he goes right into it too. The scene kicks off. He's vastly outnumbered by all these vampires, but yet it's, you know, the very choreographed scene where they start attacking him one by one, and we get this amazing sequence where he starts just, you know, dispatching them left and right. We also see that his weaponry disintegrates them, and it's our first indication that the CGI is going to be terrible.
Yeah, there are certain people online, I think, that redo old CGI to make it look as amazing as possible. And right off the top of my head, I think you may have sent this to me, or I've sent it to you. These guys did the Scorpion King. They remade what a scene in, I believe, the Scorpion, the introduction to The Rock as the Scorpion King, where he's half scorpion, and they completely redid the CGI, and it looks monumental. And I would love that treatment on this movie. You know, if there's anything to be said about going back and tweaking CGI in a flick to make it look better, I think this is maybe the best case scenario, because you don't really have to do anything else to it except make the skeletons look good, the blood look good, and the explosions look better.
This is like a perpetual thing that comes up, because, you know, I know I have this conversation with friends a lot about CGI versus all these practical effects. And I think we were talking about this because at the time of this recording, they just released a new Mission Impossible trailer, and we were looking at that. And those movies have become stunt showcases for Tom Cruise. And it led into a conversation about how we are, it's such an old school thing where we're going to see this movie to see the big thing, the big spectacle that's in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so refreshing, because someone is going through the effort of doing all this stuff. Whereas in all these other movies, like, you know, like the Marvel movies, which are sort of like the biggest thing right now, you know, in general, and in these movies, they have these great spectacles, and the cheapest and easiest route is to do it in a computerized environment. And it looks cool, but it's also sort of, it always sort of lacks something, and it always pales in comparison to some sort of practical effect. You know, like, you have Tom Cruise jumping from a helicopter into another helicopter or something, and it looks amazing, but then you have like Black Widow being chased by a CGI truck in the middle of the street, and your brain shuts off because it doesn't look like anything. And it goes back to what you're saying, where one of the things that we have discovered over time is that as the CGI gets better, and, you know, it makes the old stuff look really, really bad and always in need of updating, where we rarely need to feel like we need to update a movie's practical effects or on-camera things. You know, like George Lucas infamously did a whole lot of that, and we are still not over it. But this is a thing where it's like CGI has its time and place. Obviously, you have to, you know, when you vamp, you can't physically vaporize anybody, but this is one of the side effects that we're going to always be dealing with, no matter how good the CGI gets, as far as I'm, this is what I think.
I agree with you for the most part. I do think, like, if any movie was to be given a once over, it would be this one, you know. Yeah. And the Star Wars thing's one thing, but, you know, at this point in the game, we expect the Marvel movies and the Star Wars flicks to blow us away regardless, you know, and be innovative. But let's say a movie like Kong versus Godzilla, Godzilla versus Kong.
Yeah.
I love that movie. And you know what? It is a big popcorn chewing movie laden with special effects. You know, that kind of CGI makes me think back to going to the theater to see Independence Day, because it was like the big thing. You know, you want to see these larger than life, nutty objects destroy stuff. It serves the story better because of what he's doing. You know, it's not really superfluous. I think they tried to do their best with these effects because he's killing vampires, you know, and he's doing it in a unique way. And maybe that whole thing they got caught up in that, and it wasn't as polished as it could have been. You know, like, we could spend all day talking about the special effects, but do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I do. And I completely agree with you, because I feel like the movie does a really good job of, especially when it comes to a lot of the action scenes, where it's all, you know, stunt work and choreography. And obviously you have to use the CGI for things that are supernatural and things that you can't recreate, because they are not real. They're not possible.
Right.
And in, you know, when he's dispatching these vampires and they turn to dust, yes, that it makes perfect sense. And, you know, it gets worse the further down the line, but you're absolutely right. It's totally in service of what they're doing. And for the most part, they're doing everything in camera. And you're right. My opinions about, like, the ongoing CGI thing is because it came up recently, what you said sort of just reminded me of it. But I think we're going to talk more about that especially towards the end.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Here though, he's kicking everyone's ass, and Donald Logue is there, and he is interestingly, he kills everyone, but he impales Donald Logue's character on the wall and then sets him on fire. And I couldn't figure out exactly what the motivation was. Did I miss something here? Because he killed everyone, but let him live. Was he going to interrogate him and he got cut off? That's the only takeaway I got.
I think it was a little bit of Blade playing with the Quinn character, because he knows that he's Deacon Frost's right-hand man. I think he wanted to send a message to him. And also he kind of does that line where Blade's like, I'm trying something different. You know, he cuts the dude's arm off and also sets him on fire. Let's see what fire does to this guy. Right.
Yeah.
But then
he's toying with him.
He's toying with him, but at the same time, this is just like weird storytelling, and it makes zero sense. But when Blade shows up at the hospital, because Quinn is still alive or undead or whatever, he's coming back to life. Blade goes, I should have finished the job at the club or something like that. And it's like, yo, you killed like 40 people. You could have just killed this guy. Why not? So, yes, I agree with you that it makes no sense.
Yeah. I thought, like, if they set it up like, I have some questions for you, because at this point the police come in, Blade has to disappear. So he is set on fire. They put him out. They take his body to the hospital, thinking he's like a normal burn victim. The character bursts back to life while in the hospital and while he's being sort of autopsied. But in real life, Donald Logue is in this full burn prosthetic, you know, makeup, and there's in the ensuing fight scene, he got his actual jaw dislocated and he had to be rushed to the hospital, and he was still obviously in the burn stuff. So he goes to the real hospital for his real dislocated jaw wearing fake burns. And the story goes, he both freaked out and confused everyone for the reason why he was there.
That's such a great story.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny because you imagine just like being like, you know, like attending like an ER and then seeing this guy come in and you're thinking, this is going to be the wildest night. This is serious. And it's all just like, no. The people are trying to explain to him. It's like, it's not this. It's his jaw, actually. Don't worry about this. He's okay with that part. Just fix his mouth.
That's also a fun testament to how good that effect looked, because he looked gnarly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It looked great. And they do a really good job, actually, because I was thinking about it when they are examining him, and they make it like they put all this crispy sound work. And so every time they move it, it sounds like crackling, like bacon and stuff. I'm like, oof, they made me believe that he's like a fried, fried body.
You know what? A lot of great Foley work in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
From just, you know, like the, it's not too over the top. I feel like action movies from the 90s get a little too over the top with the wind whipping sounds.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
but they did a really good job of making a very squelchy, gross Foley with a lot of the vampire stuff in this movie.
Oh, for sure.
So, you know, this is Blade's introduction to Karen, who I guess becomes his love interest. She's in the hospital. She gets bit by the Donald Logue Quinn character, who is springing back to like undead life. And then Blade takes it upon himself to, I guess, rescue her by throwing her out of a window onto a roof.
Yeah. It's like an ongoing theme of this movie where to save someone, they sort of toss people through glass. Like it happens later with Deacon Frost throws like a young girl into like a bus stop or something. But the Donald Logue's character bursts out of his body bag and he immediately attacks Karen, who's a doctor at the hospital, and another doctor who they had sort of established like this weird previous relationship with, which I felt was kind of forced. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's only there because this comes back at the end for like a minute. She gets bitten and so infected with the vampire bite. Blade looks at her and then throws her out the window, because now the police have shown up. They shoot the burn victim, and then they shoot Blade, who looks like a crazy person in a hospital fighting a burn victim, and he spouts like my favorite line in the movie, where he yells at them about being out of their damn minds because they're just shooting at him. And I feel like the line delivery is so genuine. It feels like it's not a scripted part of the movie, as if like people started like someone skipped a cue and then Wesley Snipes actually got mad at these people.
Well, this is new territory, because at this point, Blade in the Marvel canon was almost like a forgotten franchise. And I remember when pre-production went into this movie, I was like, I remember thinking like as a teenager, like, out of all the things they're choosing to make a movie out of, it's Blade. And I think that worked very well for Wesley Snipes to ad lib a little bit, you know, because this is like this incarnation of Blade looks close to the mid 90s version in the comics. But I feel like in this particular case looks way better on film than he ever did in the books. And I think the new territory thing for him was like, they probably were like, hey, listen, like we don't really have a lot to go on. What would Blade say right now? He gets shot in the chest and he's like, MFers, are you out of your damn mind? And then they cut to the two cops that shoot him, immediately run away.
You're right in that the new ground does sort of like, you know, they're paving, they don't know that they're doing this, but, you know, Wesley Snipes and the makers of this film are paving the way for something that is going to be huge down the line, you know, and Snipes, you know, all his extra lines, his characterization, the way he nails all the action poses, mm-hmm. in at the beginning and the end of the fights, you know, like it's perfect and goes to inform a lot of the stuff that are popular now with the ad-libbing, with the mixing of the humor and the action. And you're right, and you know, it's nobody knows how these things sort of manifest, but I love that line because it stands out you know, more than any of the other lines in the movie for me.
I love it. And I also you also get an eye into the charm of the character and of Wesley Snipes as well, like specifically in that scene, in the 3 second scene, he throws her across into like another rooftop. He looks back and kind of smirks as if to say, like, you guys are never gonna catch me, you know. Yeah. And then he jumps out like superhero style, and again he sets the groundwork for all the stuff in the future. I feel like there must have been a template where they're like, look to the Blade movie to see something solid, you know, like a solid foundation for like superhero posing and stuff like that.
No, 100%. Yeah. And we will certainly talk more about this, but this movie does sort of like lay the groundwork for a lot of what we're seeing in Marvel movies and even beyond those right now.
Absolutely. So, you know, after, you know, this is your intro to Blade, he saves the future love interest, and now we get introduced to the villain of the story, Deacon Frost.
Yeah, tell me about this guy.
So Deacon Frost, played by Stephen Dorff, is not a pureblood vampire. At some point, he was a man who was bitten by a vampire and is somehow risen through the ranks of the vampire kingdom, which is kind of like, you know, they clue you in into like, your intro to this guy is amongst a committee of vampires. It's like the Illuminati of vampires from across the world, I'm assuming, led by Udo Kier.
Yeah.
Great cast. And nobody likes Deacon Frost. Deacon Frost, their whole thing is like, hey, man, listen, like, you're doing stuff that is too close to spilling out into the public. And we can't have that, because then presidents and governments are going to start cracking down on us. And we can't have that either. You know, so they give you a little in that introduction, they give you like a little backstory of like, oh, these guys have been around for hundreds of years. They're tied into the human governments and politics. And we've had a nice truce, but don't ruin it.
What we were saying before, where like the movie sort of gives you all the bits that you need to know without overdoing it. We learn that vampires come from some sort of natural thing, you know, like they are. The council makes a big deal about being pure blood or pure born vampires, because they were born as vampires. They were not humans turned into vampires. So it's like, ah, now we're adding, you know, something to the to this mythos in this movie. And we can see how like there is like a class divide, and how like the pure bloods look down at these other people, even though they're the same. And that's like the whole thing to unpack there. But Deacon Frost is like this shitty sort of young brat, and he's like smoking and acting like this, you know, like he's, you know, everyone else is like all suited up and stuffy and buttoned up, and he's sort of like in his like 90s like loungewear, sort of acting like a basically like a brat. And he and mm-hmm. but he also brings up that he's like, I don't understand why we are not just subjugating humans. They're our food. Why don't we just dominate them? Why are we playing these games? And my takeaway from this whole thing is like, from here on out, the council is just dumb and useless and ineffectual, because they make a whole big deal about, listen, we have to maintain order. It's thousands of years. This is the tricky balance that we have. And also, you know, obviously it's the plot for the movie where like they don't regard him as important, but they never sort of break it down to him going like, listen, you can't screw around with what we have because it's too precarious. This is the reasons why. And they also don't do anything about anything ever. They just sort of get angry and then just go along with whatever the hell Deacon Frost is trying to do.
Well, these are all set pieces for like Deacon Frost's motivation towards the end. Like, I feel like a lot of this movie is kind of held together with like duct tape, you know, the Vampire Council being a perfect round number of, well, not round number, but a perfect number of 12, like an even number. Or, oh, it just so happens that he also needs 12 vampires and to do what he's doing, you know, and he's trying to resurrect the blood god, and he needs these 12 vessels to get zapped by the blood god at some point, you know, and we kind of find that out later. It's very loose.
It is. And I'm just splitting hairs, but like, I was just so frustrated by it, like, because it's not only this scene is like whatever, but every time there is some sort of council scene or interaction, they literally do nothing and let this dude just walk all over their thousand-year-old system. And if you're noticing it, it gets kind of annoying, but you're just sort of like, all right, just get through this. These people suck, literally blood, but also they're assholes.
And he's also an asshole, you know, like he's kind of like Deacon Frost is kind of an unrepenting asshole, you know, just the way he treats everybody. And like, he has like this blinding ambition, and you know, we kind of find out more of that like later on. And then you kind of get like clued into like his motivations. And the movie does a good job of going back and forth. There's an even amount of Blade and an even amount of Deacon Frost. It's not like this guy's not around until the end of the movie. So he takes Karen back to his hideout, which is fascinating because he's got a really badass car. The hideout seems very fleshed out. And my whole gripe with that is later on, Whistler says, we move from city to city to catch these guys, you know? So like, that's a lot of stuff to move.
The hideout is very lived in. And I did notice when he said that, it's like, yeah, we're constantly moving. And I'm like, you feel like you haven't moved in a while.
Right. He's like, we're constantly moving. And they seem pretty settled in that like abandoned warehouse that has like a gas pump and Blade's special chair and all the weapons, also semi close to where Blade gets his serum.
Yeah, the serum thing. He has like a hookup, and that seems like someone that they're close with. So they've been there long enough to have like a rapport of this person who's important. You know, Blade gives him like a pound, and they bond as if this is a, you know, I thought it was someone as familiar as with Blade as he was to Whistler. So he was like he seemed like a close person, but only gets this one scene. And again, it doesn't jive with their whole like, yeah, we're sort of, you know, nomadic rovers hunting people, or not people, but vampires.
Yeah. So like, you know, Blade's whole thing with Whistler is like, you know, Whistler met Blade when he was 13, took him off the streets, trained him. And now they just go out and hunt vampires together, like total badass, as they should. It's interesting because the movie doesn't do a good job. I want to go back to what I was saying before. It doesn't do a good job of explaining how they're moving from city to city, because every single thing in this movie seems like it's taking place very close to where Blade lives.
Everything is within like a short drive.
Exactly. Then there's no traffic.
Yeah. Even at the end where they go to they go to the long lost temple of the blood god. And I was like, that was a drive. It was the same evening. They got there like in a half an hour.
Everything is conveniently where Blade is at the beginning of the movie, you know, like the underground nightclubs, the underground like clubs to keep the vampires away from sunlight, the chamber of the gods, you know, that hidden, the whole hidden thing, the large vampire who was like their computer guy, you know, like everybody, it seems like they congregated into like this nameless city.
Do you think that when they're like, yeah, we move around a lot hunting vampires, but they only move from like the same, like they're in the same city and they just move to like different parts of the same city, and it's like, well, our scope is kind of limited.
You know what? That would be funny. Like if they were in Manhattan and then they were like, well, we're going to be on the Lower East Side for the next 3 weeks. And then we're going to be in Midtown for the next 2 weeks after that. And
well, then our lease is up and then we got to go to this other warehouse.
And then we got an Airbnb in Hell's Kitchen. And like, you know, like I think it makes sense for the movie. Absolutely. But it doesn't make sense if you like take a step back and they're like, hey, wait a minute.
It sounds like they're crossing the country hunting vampires, but it's really just kind of like, yeah, we're just going from borough to borough.
And it's also not specifically like anybody on that council chamber. Like, I guess they're finding everybody bit by bit. And this latest mission is Deacon Frost, who's like the upstart.
Yeah, we are sort of led to believe that Blade is following a trail. And like when he knows who Quinn is and he knows who Deacon Frost is. And we find out later that Frost knows a whole lot about Blade. But it's all very, very localized.
Yeah, it's very convenient, but you know, it's fine. This is an action movie. I'm not really expecting Shakespeare here.
Action Shakespeare. Once Karen is patched up and she is sort of brought up to speed, they Blade and Whistler kind of release her back into the wild, saying like, listen, you know about you've had an encounter with the vampire, you know, you have to, you know, go into hiding and get out of town and stuff like that. And she's sort of confused about all this stuff, but she re-enters the world and goes back to her apartment, but also is like really suspicious because she's like, it's daytime. Like, what do I have to be scared of? But she quickly encounters the familiars, the human people that are subservient to the vampires and do their will in hopes that they'll be turned. One comes to her apartment. I wouldn't say posing as a cop. He probably is a cop, but also as a familiar. And he goes to attack her because she's a loose end, but Blade had sort of done this, let her go so he could, he's using her as bait essentially, because he's trying to, this is an ongoing thing. He's slowly sort of climbing up the ladder, trying to get to Deacon Frost. He goes over there and they also use him along too, because they're trying to get a lead onto where Deacon is and what he's up to. And he leads them to this archive that Frost has been sort of digging through, because he's trying to find some ancient vampire lore about the blood god, to, you know, he wants to use his information for nefarious purposes, and Blade's trying to figure that out. The council isn't really happy with it, because he's sort of like, hey, you're listening to, you're in this archive and you shouldn't be here. This is for you know, like level two vampires and you're just level one, that kind of thing. But it does lead to our next sort of action set piece, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of funny too, because this whole, it's very convenient. So everything again is happening in the same area. And also it just so happens that Karen is a hematologist and she works with blood. And guess who has a blood disease? Everybody in this movie.
Basically, yeah.
You kind of get the inkling that Deacon Frost is up to something. He's very driven, he's very focused, and he has parties every night.
Yeah, he's got it's like his like a sexy vampire entourage. And you know, when you know, it's nighttime, like everyone, like the party kicks off. So he's having a party, but he's also sort of like he's downloading you know, a 90s version of like, he's got like his Vampire Encarta like CD-ROM that he's going through, and he's trying to like translate vampire stuff. And the vampire party's kicking off. One cool detail is that they're watching the old school Mortal Kombat in the background.
From, this is 98, so 3 years Yeah, we're watching like Mortal Kombat from like 95.
The other New Line Cinema property where they were watching that. Which I thought was cool. I like the idea of like vampires who are like these very like sexy, horny, you know, beasts of the night who hunt down people. But like they're like, yo, let's have like a movie party and we're gonna watch Mortal Kombat. Like, I love Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, you know, like I like the vampires in this movie because, again, it's not the typical vampire fare. If you were cursed with immortality and you knew and you would age super slow, wouldn't you, I guess, at some point be like, I'm just gonna party.
I think so, but I think it's really funny how they party like 90. They do like 90s, you know, young people parties. Like, no one's like, I'm like a vampire and I'm old and I'm gonna have like a disco party because I was bit in the 70s. They're all like very like contemporary, you know.
Well, I think Deacon Frost people are the contemporary ones, as opposed to like the chamber guys, because those guys just they want to avoid attention and they're just like these kind of like vampire oligarchs, I guess.
Yeah, they're partied out.
I wish they went into that more, you know, like that lore is fascinating of, let's say, Dragonetti, Udo Kier's character, where he said he was born a vampire. So how old is he? What's his deal? Where did he come from? I'd be very interested in that, you know. And also, I feel like if they ran their course with the trilogy, Blade 2 is phenomenal. Blade 3 is not that great. Could have done with some Dracula. Because Dracula does exist in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, doesn't he pop up in the third one?
I think he does. I don't remember too much of the third one. But some of the stuff from this movie shows up in the third one in a weird way where they're like siphoning people for blood. You know,
Patton Oswalt was the Dracula in the third one. Unless I got it wrong.
Was he?
Yeah, I might be remembering it differently. I might have made up a better movie in my head.
Yeah, I watched it once and was just like, this is not that great.
The thing, too, it's like, you know, what you're saying is, yeah, like you have like these natural born vampires and they sort of allude that vampires age because they're like older looking people, but like at a very slow thing. And that's sort of the trade off where Blade has like the vampire superpowers, but he doesn't have the weaknesses, but he ages normally. So it's a sort of like, oh, it's sort of like a, you know, like no harm, no foul. He's like, I was going to age normally anyway. Might as well have like cool superpowers. But these guys have all the vampiric capabilities, but are very long lived. But yeah, in that all that time, they never ran into like some like brat like Deacon Frost, who's, you know, like who wants to party and do all this other stuff. Like, I can't believe that they have like that old of a society and no one has sort of like threatened to like shake the loose foundations of that everything is. But, you know, it would be cool. But and again, like they are like super like contemporary things. And I think it'd be funny if like Udo Kier was yelling at him about like, you and your techno music, you don't know how real vampires party.
You also kind of get the sense that Udo Kier turned Deacon Frost into a vampire.
Kind of a fatherly relationship. Yeah.
I don't know. It was that scene where Udo Kier confronts him in the bedroom is a little weird because just the way he touched them on the face.
Yeah, everyone does weird touching in this.
There's a lot of face touching in this.
Everyone's like super like weirdly touchy. Like, yeah, it's like, it's what is it about being a vampire that makes you just so like mad horny and touchy?
The thirst.
Is it the thirst? Is the thirst with thirst comes intimacy?
It's the thirst. I think everybody just needs constant blood, you know?
Yeah.
Constantly. Even Blade, too. That's a big focal point of the movie that we didn't really touch on, where like he takes this vampire serum that suppresses his hunger. So at some point, he's away from his serum and becomes kind of like a feral. We'll get into it. But, you know, like that kind of plays into it. And her being a hematologist plays into it. But now, you know, like you're kind of, the movie's starting to ramp up. Deacon Frost kidnaps Dragonetti, Udo Kier's character. And, you know, now the vampires are kind of, you get the hint that they're jealous of Will Smith. You get the hint. They're very jealous of Will Smith. They're very jealous of Wesley Snipes' Blade because he can walk around during the daylight. He has all the positives. And the only negative, like you said, is that he ages at a normal pace. The vampires discover sunscreen, whatever it is, like SPF 9000. And then they kidnap Dragonetti, take him to a beach, and then say, hey, you know, like there's nothing like watching a sunrise. And then they're like, oh, you've never seen a sunrise because you were born a vampire. And they, I feel like of all the effects budget, they put most of it into Dragonetti melting in the sunrise, which was really cool. And it was almost like a Raiders of the Lost Ark style melting.
it was really over the top, and it's brutal as hell, but it's really awesome. But it's like, it's as awesome as it is disgusting. And it's like one of the better CGI things, because they just really hammer it home. But yeah, it's again, it's like sort of like twisting that knife where it's like, you keep calling us, you know, like of, you know, like we're like lower class, but you know, like you've never even seen the sunrise and, you know, all this other stuff. And I think it'd be funny if like when they set him up and they're all like decked out in their like sunscreen and helmets and stuff like that, and they brutalize him because they're angry with him. But it would have been funny, he was like, as the sun rose and he screamed, he's like, ah, oh, this is so cool, and then exploded.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been like that would have worked for me.
But also, he exploded, and I feel like exploding vampires are a great part of this movie.
They blow up a lot. Like, they're like, oh well, you know, the garlic and the silver thing, it's sort of legend, it's got, the truth is lost in the legend, but it's real. They have a severe allergy to it. It's an explodey allergy.
Very explodey allergy.
I am so glad I don't have explosive allergies, my poor cats.
So at this point, we're getting the idea that Deacon Frost is trying to take over. He killed Dragonetti. Bang, now he's going to confront Blade. So he confronts him in public. And he has, like, he found a little girl that he, I guess, threatened or maliced into just kind of being his hostage. And, you know, they're in a very public park, and he has this confrontation with Blade where he's telling Blade, like, hey, why don't you join us? You know, and I like the way Deacon Frost plays as a character. He's very driven, but it doesn't seem like he's prone to outbursts.
Pretty. Yeah. Like he doesn't have a whole lot of over the top yelling things. Like, he gets kind of frustrated with Quinn. He gets frustrated with the he kills the familiar that sort of screwed up and led Blade around. But like at this point, they, you know, the vampires have this archive. He has already gotten the information he needed. Blade is sort of led there by the familiar, but is sort of too late and has this great bang out fight. But he gets some copies of the vampire Bible as sort of like a clue as to what's going on. And I think he steals a hard drive too. So Whistler goes to decode it, but yeah, everything is pretty like measured. And, you know, he's talking to Blade going like, we don't need to, he goes, I know everything about you. We don't need to fight. We don't need to, you can join us. It's like, what are you really? Are you really like a human? You know, like you're a vampire, like just be with us. Like, why are you doing this, why are you pretending that you're not a vampire? Were you like, I have a bloodlust. I have a bloodthirst and kind of a bloodlust for vampires, but you have a bloodthirst and have these powers. You know, if it walks like a vampire and it talks like a vampire, maybe you're a vampire.
I want to dive more into that, but that's one thing that the movie does not the best job of.
You, what do you, how so?
Like in the lore.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, Blade's very serious and it is like a very mission based movie. But it seems like as the movie progresses, Blade is like kind of, he's not doing a great job.
As far as the mission is concerned?
Right. As far as the mission is concerned, because there's a lot of stuff that's happening that he's kind of like, he's losing it a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think like, you know, he's got, his serum is he's sort of building resistance to it. Whistler's dying, essentially. Like, they sort of reveal this. Karen, who's bitten by the vampire, she's like, everyone's sort of like, well, listen, we're all sort of in our own way. We're kind of like, we're all sort of like, our days are numbered. Something happens. But Karen is the one who sort of rallies them, going like, no, I'm a scientist. Let me figure this out. And so she gets to work, at least for the vampirism stuff. And, you know, like, again, it's like they are driven by revenge. You know, Whistler, he lost his family to vampires. Blade is who he is. And they are so fixated on this, you know, like having Deacon Frost offer an alternative or, you know, and just sort of posit this. I could see how this would, if this movie was less about action and more about sort of exploring this whole thing and having someone be sort of tempted or shaken to saying like, you know, maybe there's a different way of living or, you know, let's explore who you really are, not so much who you think you are, but hey, it's an action movie and Blade is not even hearing that. So he's just, he starts shooting at him.
There's no doubt. There's zero doubt in Blade's mind. He's like, absolutely not. You know, like there's no way. And again, but that's a very interesting take on, I think, the Deacon Frost character, where it's like, for him, he's so full of his own hubris that he thinks there's no stakes. Literally and figuratively, like there is
that,
zero stakes for him because he's like, hey, listen, I'm the young guy. I'm pretty much immortal. You know, like I'm going to rule this shit. And listen, you're going to come with me or not. We're going to kill it anyway. But we need you for some reason. And then the reason is revealed that Dean Frost is going through all this shit to resurrect the blood god. And Blade is an integral part of it. And it is revealed that because of his nature, he's the chosen one that will unlock the blood god in this special chamber while Deacon Frost kidnaps the 12 other vampire council members for them to stand in their exact glyphs while he smushes Blade in a coffin, and Blade's blood will activate the spirit of the vampire god, the blood god.
Bleeds Blade's blood.
Right. You know, it's a little convoluted.
This is where the wheels start to come off. But before we do that, like just touching on a little bit of the characterization before the movie completely like goes off the deep end. In the meantime, Karen has developed a cure to the vampirism, where it's like, I won't cure Blade, but I can cure people who have been bitten. You know, anyone who's turned, this is like sort of a vaccine against that. So she cures herself. Deacon Frost sort of ambushes the hideout. And they brutalize Whistler and they kidnap Karen. Karen and sort of reveals going like, I could cure you, you know, like, and but he's too caught up in this power thing where it's like, it's not about like he had just like how he offered Blade a different way of doing things or an out from this thing that he's like, you know, this fixation. She's like, I'm giving you an out. Like you say like you, all of this is, you know, like you don't want to whatever your motivations are. You're clearly like power hungry because I'm giving you a way to just not be a vampire. But you're too wrapped up into it where it's like you want all this. And he gets angry, you know, because she's like, you're basically just like a walking disease. And he's like, I'll show you. And then, yeah, like gathers like the ineffectual council of like, you know, shuffly dudes into a chamber that is conveniently still like within driving distance of everything.
Right. And we also have to mention that, you know, Blade, they really, just to kind of lure Blade out, the vampires really do a number on Whistler. And when Blade finds him, he's very close to death, takes Blade's gun, and we're to believe that he shoots himself.
There's a couple of funny things about this is like Blade, for as stoic as Wesley Snipes is playing Blade, he does allow a little bit of empathy to come through here, where he looks upset that Whistler, the person that he cares about, is dying, and he's really like bloodied up. And there's a part where like Whistler is talking to him and Blade is like tending to him, but he has like this tiny little piece of gauze and he's sort of like dabbing on him.
Yeah.
But he's just like head to toe covered in blood. And it's just sort of like, let me, you got a little schmutz there, buddy.
But I think it was also like Blade, the character, couldn't deal with it. So it's very innocent in a strange way.
I get it. Hey, but it's just so funny, like in context where it's like, he feels like he has to do so. He's like, there. He wants to sort of show that he's caring. But, you know, on the face of it, it's like, there's this completely wrecked dude and he's sitting there like dabbing him with like a little bit of gauze. Just so, let me help you. Got a little thing there.
This is also like foreshadowing because I don't think that Blade 2 is greenlit yet at this point. You know, like Marvel didn't realize they had a success because in Blade 2 Whistler comes back, you know.
Whistler comes back, yeah, spoiler, but also like later he has the gun, so I was like, he went back, and so there was probably like this awkward moment where he was like, back, I got my gun.
I got my gun. Maybe he had multiple guns, but yeah. Then like, you know, it goes into like Blade's prepping for the final battle, and he's ready.
He's ready. He like, he has this house plant that's sort of like a fixture, but then he cuts the roots of the plant symbolically. What this symbolizes, I don't know. He assaults Frost's headquarters, and he enters Frost's bedroom, and the bed, which is like this weird like future coffin.
Cool bed.
It was cool, but like, yeah, it has like, it like looks like it locks down and all this other stuff. But do they sleep in coffins? I guess they sleep wherever they want, right?
It's not really addressed, you know, but I would assume as long as it's in darkness, they're fine. But I like the fact that he just had like this crazy self-sealing coffin.
Yeah, it was coffin-like, and I get like, yeah, there's sort of like just to hammer home that like it's a solid chamber, you know. But opens up, and there's like one of his concubines in there, and she confronts Blade, and turns out it's his mother. She's alive,
And this is where it gets more convoluted than what it is. It's very, everything is such a neat little package. Everything is happening in the same city. There's no travel and his mom's there, you know? And he has to confront his now vampiric mom who tells him I love being a vampire.
Yeah. She was attacked and bitten by Deacon Frost. He is the one that turned his mother and in a sense is the person that made Blade the Daywalker by biting his then pregnant mother and transferring all that stuff. So this is weird incestual stuff going on here.
It's very bizarre, but also what's even more bizarre is I think Deacon Frost was like, yeah, by the way, I'm like your dad, you know, which Blade doesn't know. Blade's been doing this for his entire life. And I feel like it's just a weird way for him to come to the to get this reveal, you know?
Yeah, it seems like it's a weird thing that should have been more impactful. And I think the movie tried to do that, but I don't think it stuck the landing because it's like, I know everything about you. And you know, here's the big twist. It's like, I am your father, vampirically speaking.
Ish, I'm your father, ish.
Your father is, I'm sort of, yeah. Your mom's new boyfriend. And call me dad, but this is enough of a stunner for them to get the drop on Blade and they can take him to the bloodletting.
Very psychological stunner.
Yeah, and then physically stunned with stun rods and stuff,
right? So I mean, I guess, you know, that makes sense. You know, they're just electrocuting the crap out of him, and they stick him in this crazy coffin that bleeds him into this giant chamber to unleash the blood god. And listen, it's working.
It's a perfectly blade shaped mold that they fit him in, like he's an action figure.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the interesting thing about this is if there was good CGI in the movie, I feel like this would have been the perfect place to do it, because when the vampiric council is on their little glyphs and the blood starts dripping on their foreheads, skeletal winged vampire creatures, their bones essentially come out of their mouths and fly towards the apex of this citadel that they're in. And I watched it yesterday and I was like, man, if this looked good, it would have so much more of an impact.
It sounds way more metal than what it actually was.
Again, you don't have to do much, but tweak those skeletons and it would look so much more infinitely badass. And it was it's fine. I feel like this is one of those movies where it's it looks like a Windows screensaver, you know, like the CGI. And it takes you out of it a little bit. The whole last 20 minutes of the movie with the CGI, it's very heavy on the CGI. And apparently they did a reshoot too, where they spent millions of dollars because the original ending had, I think, Deacon Frost turn into a creature.
He was a weird blob of floaty blood, but it was a really lousy ending and they didn't really have a confrontation. You know, he had a confrontation with a weird CGI monster. And they redid a lot of this stuff into this. This is the better ending, surprisingly.
So again, it's a straight up action movie and you get a lot of fun stuff at this, you know, during this. So Blade has to kill his mom. He also has to have the sex scene in the movie is Karen giving her blood to Blade.
Yeah. So they're both in the same place. And so she, they mentioned that weird forced relationship. They, for some reason, the doctor who was her ex-boyfriend from the beginning of the movie is a zombie in the pit that she's sort of thrown into. She kills him and then she rescues Blade, who's first of all, physically bled out and also dejected because he got caught. He's got this sort of, you know, this bombshell where his mom is alive. Deacon Frost is his vampo dad.
He's giving
up. He's totally given up and his mom comes and gives him a weird exposition speech. And that's also super horny and weird, you know, she's talking real close to his mouth. Anyway, Karen comes in, saves the day. And then she's you know, drink from me, you know, feed off of me. And so he regains his strength by he gets a vamp out finally. And that gives him the power to start going in, you know, the useless council is dead. Frost is Super Saiyan Frost and he's got all these powers, but Blade's there and he's got to kick everyone else's ass first. And he starts running through these guys in a spectacular fashion.
it's pretty awesome. You know, like it's really awesome. Again, it's super badass. Also, like the concentration of the sunglasses, I've always loved because you need something kind of cheesy for like, it was like the perfect amount of cheese, you know, where Quinn, Donald Logue is saying like, hey, thanks for the shades, dude. You know, like totally chewing the scenery again. And then you see Blade just whip out like, I guess like a silver garrote from his uniform.
Yeah.
Donald Logue runs at him. He slices a dude's head off. The glasses land perfectly in his hand. I think he does a sunglasses bit in every single movie. Blade 2 may have been my favorite one. I think Whistler throws the shades at him from like an entire warehouse away and he catches them. But real cool. He gets the sunglasses. He's sword fighting. A big thing in this movie is his sword that explodes, which comes into play a lot, which I'm glad they used. Him sword fighting Deacon Frost was a lot of fun. And the only problem I have is how awful Deacon Frost looked at the end of the movie.
You talking about when he is like monstered up or just in general?
When he's monstered up, because at some point, Karen creates a serum he doesn't create a serum for Blade. Blade takes Karen's work and makes like explodey vampire juice.
It's basically what it is.
Right. So like if he sticks these syringes in these vampires, they start getting like real bulbous, like almost like Arnold in the beginning of Total Recall when he's exposed to the air on Mars. You know, right, it's like this horrifying, they get all like bulbous and swollen and then their bodies just give up and they explode. So Blade's got all these things on him. He shoots almost everyone into Deacon Frost.
He shoots all of them and then he like roundhouse kicks the last one directly into his face.
And then he explodes.
And then he like bubbles up and then bursts. But up until that point, it's like a pretty cool fight. You know, and it's funny because like when he kills Quinn, you know, up until this point, like every time Donald Logue has had an opportunity to just go nuts and have fun, the movie's better for it. And this is the final thing where it's just kind of like, you know, he could have just completely killed him at the beginning just as easily as this part, but you know, we would have lost that performance. And the fight is actually pretty cool. I'm glad that they decided to put two people together and actually have like a sword fight, because it's fun for what it is. It's like a real confrontation. But then yeah, like if very comically, like he turns into this gross monster because he can't, because of the superpowers, he can't just like cut him down like anybody else, so he has to use like this thing. And he dies, the vampire council is dead, all these other vampires are dead. That's it. So like Blade sort of wins and says to Karen, like, I'm gonna thank you but no on the cure thing. I'm gonna continue to hunt vampires. And that's the end of the movie.
Yeah, the end of the movie is him ending up in Russia.
Yeah, he went from like I've killed all the vampires in this one city, time to go to Moscow.
And that, which is kind of cool, you know, because he does move around.
It's sort of like it in the context of the movie. It's like, I get that, like, they have to show him like still out there, that they just sort of like picked Russia. It just seems sort of out of the blue, but it's like, all right, well, whatever. He's in Russia. Cool.
And that kind of clues like, well, maybe there's a sequel. Maybe there won't be a sequel. You know, like the story is still unfolding, but super badass, man. Like, I love this movie. What about you?
Blade 2, Mission to Moscow. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. To me, like Blade is like this perennial badass movie that it's as much the fun to watch now as it was when it came out. It's like it's a 90s action movie with filled with all the tropes, but it really holds up. The fight scenes are done really well, and like we talked about how Blade, the character, is really solid. You know, you can tell that Wesley Snipes put 100% into the fights, the choreography, just portraying Blade as this stoic warrior and having fun with it. And, you know, whatever stories you may have heard about how he is to work on these movies or whatever, like the point is, like, the work that he puts into this, like he took it very, very seriously, and the movie's all the better for it. You mentioned this before, but it's really funny to think about like how like this movie sort of what it looks like now. From this, we're looking at it back from the age of like, we're deep into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, like that's the ubiquitous thing. Comic book movies were not heavy hitters like that, like, you know, then as they are now. And even like the big ones like Superman and Batman still struggle to adapt certain concepts. But in a very real way, this is the movie that kicked off what will become the MCU. It's the first R-rated Marvel movie. It's the first Marvel movie with like a black male and female leads. It's a lot of these firsts that it does get sort of forgotten about. You know, we should also point out in many ways, a lot of the aspects, a lot of things in this movie sort of beat the Matrix to the punch in a few things. You know, you have like bullet time effects, you know, like a secret war going on in the background of society, martial arts gunplay, and like a stone-faced hero in a black trench coat doing all like these action things, techno music, all this other stuff. That's just sort of like worth sort of exploring, because it's sort of sets this, the brickwork for a lot of great things that came, you know, after it. It should get more credit in that regard. But I mean, on its own, it's a fun movie, still kicks ass. If we got one, it would have been great, but we got a great sequel, and then we got a third one. And now we got this reboot where it's like officially going to be integrated in the universe that it sort of ultimately created. So I think it's a fun movie and important in a lot of ways.
I agree with that. I think it's very important. I also really do like how in the movie, you know, late 90s movie making was still movie making from like the 70s and 80s in like a weird way. And what I really enjoyed about this, it's like, it's actually a very progressive movie. If you think about it, there's nothing to do with any racial issues at all in this movie. Mm-hmm. It's just the fact that these are all vampires and that's it. And they're after Blade, and he's the key to unlocking like this weird vampire dream of a society where they rule everything. Mm-hmm. And super strong lead, great character, great female lead. You know, it, I think it definitely a groundbreaking movie. I feel like people need to talk about that more. And I do like how, you know, we're gonna get Mahershala Ali as Blade, great choice. But also, I think a fun little tidbit there is in the third season of True Detective, it was Mahershala Ali starring opposite Stephen Dorff. You know, so you kind of got like a weird Blade Deacon Frost thing for like a full season of like a TV show. You know, that kind of weird comic stuff makes me giggle. I like that.
Yeah, I get that.
But man, just go out there and watch Blade. It's so great. Even the TV show was fun with Sticky Fingers as Blade.
I never saw it.
It's fun. It's very like, it's obviously very toned down. You know, it's not very effects heavy, but he does a good job of Blade. Like, he's bald. He's got like tattoos. Like, yeah, it's like you can see like more tattoos and stuff. It's almost akin to like, you ever see the Sarah Connor Chronicles?
I know. Yeah, I think I saw more of that than I did. I was more aware of that than I was of the Blade show.
It's almost like the same production value, you know, where it's like we're relying heavier on the mythology than the super crazy special effects, you know,
for sure.
Take us out, dude.
Well, that's going to be it for us. Thank you for joining the Film Class Heroes in our talk about Blade. We hope to catch you again soon. And, you know, don't check your neck, I guess, as they say in the vampire world.